Welcome. Today is Wednesday, February 15th. Welcome to the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. We had a longer agenda up until about yesterday, and then we had a couple of the bills that for reasons needed to be delayed a little bit, so we are going to only take up one bill today, Senate File 1675, which Senator Benson is the author, and I believe this is a bill that was brought to us by the department.
Yes.
And I'm not going to testify in your place, Senator Benson, but I will turn it over to you, and we can proceed. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Excuse me one second. I just want to also recognize that we do have a quorum. So thank you.
And when the community heard that two bills got pulled yesterday, they decided to bring forward enough controversy that we can fill as much time as you'd like to. So
that's right.
We'll keep these conversations short, vigorous, and to the point. Overall, good legislation going forward. It launches off of Senate File 1173, which we passed and is still waiting for us in the House, and that caused a little bit of confusion. We're going to focus on child protection, child permanency and adoption requirements, and then there are some federal conformities. The department has done a significant amount of work on this bill, and so I'm going to let them lead the testimony. I'm happy to answer questions, and for those areas of controversy, we are going to welcome testifiers to the table. Again, we'll have short, rigorous conversations and resolve the issues between here and a vote to move it to judiciary.
So, members, just so you understand, this bill we are going to try to move from committee, and it needs to go to judiciary. I have heard this morning that there may be a couple of questions about things, and it would give us an opportunity to work with interested parties to resolve those issues. But our hope is to try to move it to judiciary this today. So, welcome to our committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning. I'm Christine Borsheim. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I'm the Child Safety Permanency Division Director. Good morning to the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to present the department's child welfare policy bill.
Ms. Worship, could I ask you just to make sure the microphone is close to you? We have had some issues with acoustics in this room. I apologize, but as much as you can, get the microphone close so members can hear and others.
Certainly. Is that better?
I hope so. I can hear. If anybody can't hear, raise your hand, but thanks.
Okay, thank you. As Senator Benson mentioned in her remarks, the bill covers some new policy areas that we'll present in some detail. And as she said, I'm sure many of you recognize that the bill in front of you really picks up from the policy work that we introduced last year. A number of the provisions that were set aside last year had to do with the adoption of children under state guardianship. Over the intervening year, we've had the opportunity to meet with a broad community stakeholder group. Over several meetings, in addition to doing consultation with, small groups representing this to our advisory committees and so on and so forth. So the bill and the amendment that you're seeing today actually reflects the feedback from stakeholders by what is included and actually just as much by what's not included in it. This is a large bill. A lot of it is actually under the jurisdiction of the judiciary, so I'll probably not go into as much detail about those provisions of the bill unless you want. But my plan is to kind of do a broad overview of this and then be prepared to respond to questions otherwise.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, I have the A2 amendment that I would like to move.
All right. We could, I believe, treat this as an author's amendment. Is that
I would
desire?
Appreciate an author's amendment. And please help me out. I am a little rusty.
Why don't we do this? Why don't we just adopt this as an author's amendment, and then you can feel free to talk about the bill as it has been amended.
Okay.
So, members, the A2 amendment is before you, and Senator Benson moves to adopt the A2 as an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, Senator
and
Benson.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, we moved that through rather quickly. There are small technical amendments then to the bill. If Joan, Senate Counsel, I apologize, can walk us through the technical change to the A2 amendment.
Sorry, go ahead, Joan.
Mr. Chair and
Sorry,
Senator, Ms. actually, Ms. the technical amendments are to your next amendment, the A3.
I apologize. I wrote those incorrectly in my notes. Let us proceed with the author's amendment, bill as amended.
And Senator Benson, did you want to adopt the A3 at this point as well, or is that something that you want to treat separately?
I have been advised it's best to wait. We'll have this conversation and
right.
then a separate conversation.
Okay. Very good.
Okay. Some of the new provisions in the bill are the provisions that expand the protection under the Safe Place for Newborns Act. If you are familiar with this part, the Safe Haven for New or Safe Place for Newborns Act is an act that provides for mothers or someone that they have designated in their place to bring a baby to a safe place if that's within a short time after the child's birth. What we are doing in the bill this year is expanding the definition of where a safe place is. Under our current provisions, the only place where a mother or a designee can bring the baby is to a hospital. So we've expanded that to include other locations, such as healthcare clinics that provide urgent care access, a law enforcement agency or fire department during their hours of operation. And we've also expanded the time frame from 72 hours to 7 days in which the mother or her designee can relinquish the custody of the baby.
Mr. Chair, are you taking questions now?
Senator Higgins, let's maybe let the witnesses just present the bills, and then we'll have plenty of opportunity for questions. And so if you could hold off on that.
Okay.
Continue. We would like to hear an overview of the bill, and just and then we'll take some questions at that point.
That works fine. Some other expansions in there is adding in that a 911 responder can be called to take custody of the child. It does clarify that the child needs to be relinquished to a person, not just to a location. It provides immunity for those persons receiving the child. And it also provides for some county agency responsibility and court action. When children enter, are relinquished their custody under these provisions, the county agency takes custody of the child and they move to a placement and adoption. There are also some additions this year to birth match requirements. That's actually in a Section 49 of the bill, but it's related to some child safety provisions. Birth match happens in the child protection system when information from birth records from the Department of Health is matched with records from the child protection agency, and if there's something that is in that parent's history that would indicate a threatened injury to the child, there's a report made to the county agency to start an investigation or an assessment that deals with the child's safety. There's a number of provisions in the bill that support early identification, location, and involvement of non-custodial parents. These provisions are found in Section 1, in Section 17, and Section 20 of the bill. Under Section 1, it provides for access to child support data for the purposes of finding fathers or relatives. This is actually also a
Mr. Chairman.
Senator, excuse me.
Would it be possible for you just to give us the page that you're on so that it's easier for us to
yes,
find?
Yes, I can do that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Warshak.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Benson.
If I could recommend, Senate Counsel has done a very good job of outlining this bill, and it refers to the sections and then the part of the bill that is specifically referenced, and they have also noted that those sections that are in bold with an asterisk are the ones that apply primarily to this committee.
All right. Thank you. So, Ms. Warsham, can you point us to, as Senator Newman has requested, the page that you're referring to?
Yes, I can. Section 1 of the bill is on page 5. And And the language that I'm referring to there is actually the strikeout language that clarifies the data practices matters, the child, the data sharing between child support and child welfare.
So, and just so I understand it, and this probably is one of those issues that's likely to be more the concern of the Judiciary Committee, what we're saying is that previously that this data could only be used for establishing who's the parent, and now we're broadening that use of the data. Is that essentially what's happening here?
That's correct.
Okay. All right.
Okay. In Section 17 of the bill, it's found on pages 13 through 15. These provisions cover the six-month permanency progress review hearings for children in foster care. The change that we are proposing this year is that this hearing, which previously was just for children 8 and under, will be for all children in foster care. The purpose of the permanency progress review hearing is really at that time of the foster care placement to make sure that everything that needs to be done to achieve reunification for that child is being done. The services are being provided in a timely manner. It also gives the opportunity for relatives to come forward and represent themselves to the court as someone who is interested in taking custody of the child if, in fact, they are not able to be reunified.
Mr. Chair, do we have a fiscal note on this bill? To find out, I would assume there's extra cost to that.
Well, Senator Higgins, that was going to be my question as well, so I appreciate that. And I guess that would be the question, is there a fiscal note attached to the bill for this provision or any other provisions?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, there is no fiscal note to the bill. These are court hearings. When a child is in foster care, there are court hearings convened every 90 days, according to current processes. This just enhances the content and the intent of that review hearing. There's actually been a summary document put together that kind of documents that there's no cost to the court for any of these provisions.
We'll continue to take us through the bill, and we'll try to hold our questions if we can. So please continue.
That's perfectly fine. Section 20 of the bill is on pages 20 to 22. And this is another area that covers relative search and notification requirements. Many provisions in last year's bill really enhanced our efforts to identify relatives early, engage them in the permanency process. There's more language this year that continues on that. So on pages 20, 21, and 22, you will see some strikeouts. An addition that adds rights of relatives to receive notice of the permanency progress review hearings that we just mentioned. It also eliminates the parents' abilities to refuse to participate in a relative search unless there's been some kind of situation of past family or domestic violence that would create a safety concern. That's also a federal requirement issue. See what's in the Ms. White's summary here. The next, like I said, several sections of this bill that start on page 6 and essentially go through page 48 have to do with the movement of adoption for kids under state guardianship out of Chapter 259 into Chapter 260C. Those are the areas of the bill that really are under the jurisdiction of the judiciary. But for purposes of your interest in it, what it really helps us accomplish is a more seamless pathway to permanency from when children enter into foster care, that when there's a termination of parental rights, that a new legal process does not then start under an adoption legal process. There are other changes that are made in these sections. So I don't know how much detail you would like me to go into on these particular sections of the bill.
Well, I think have you Is there anything more that you want to talk about the bill in a general way, or do you want to start to get into some of the questions? And what's your...
Just two other okay. brief things then. There's also Section 2 and Sections 50 to 53. Those are later in the bill on pages 54 to 59 that eliminate the Child Maltreatment Review Panel. This was actually something that was omitted last year. It was intended to be in the bill. Right now, if there's a facility investigation of child maltreatment and there is no finding of maltreatment, there can be a request for a facility review or a panel's convened to review that that finding. It's a panel that's rarely used and has no authority to overturn any findings, so we're asking for that panel to be eliminated, and then any references in our statute to that panel would be deleted in this bill.
Okay, thank you. And members, going back to the summary that Senator Benson referred to, there are some sections in the bill that are asterisked and highlighted in bold that are indicated as ones that might be more pertinent to the jurisdiction of this committee. And I know there are members of this committee that also serve on the Judiciary Committee. And I guess I would just suggest, not, of course, prevent anyone who wants to ask any question about anything, but if there are questions that might be more pertinent to this committee, let's try to address those and leave some of the judiciary issues to that committee if that's appropriate. So, Senator Higgins, you indicated earlier that you have some. Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank the author. When I spoke with the agency about this bill, one of my concerns was, especially as a nurse, the safe place for the babies, that they weren't just being left at a door someplace, because when you're in crisis, when we had that conversation, when you're in crisis, sometimes you're not thinking straight. So I want to thank you for putting the language in the bill. It makes me more comfortable to go home and talk to my hospitals and my fire departments. You know, I'm rural, and these buildings aren't open 24 hours a day. So I just want to thank you for taking that all into consideration.
Thank you.
Senator Benson. Mr. Chair, there are other sections in this bill. I think we have hit a break, so let's bring up the safe place for newborns. There are people who would like to testify.
All right.
And we'll see if we can have that discussion. Short, sweet, to the point, hear everybody's issues, and know that this will be resolved between now and Judiciary.
All right. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Benson, the reason for 72 hours to 7 days, and perhaps somebody that is going to testify can refer to that.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, when the department brought this to me, I thought that was a reasonable accommodation to allow mothers to get home from the hospital, families to get settled after those first few days, and then perhaps realize the gravity of the situation that they're in. And I can ask the department to speak more specifically to what other states do, but that, as an author, is what made me feel it was a reasonable adjustment.
So, Senator Benson, you're looking for some testimony at this point, and I have on my list Sherry Munyon and Steve Coring. I pronounced your names correctly. Thank you for being here this morning, and just would ask that you identify yourselves for the record, and just remind you again to try to keep the microphone close. For whatever reason, there are some acoustic issues in this room. So,
Mr. Chairman, I do have handouts for the committee.
We will get a page to those handouts for the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sherry Munyon. I represent the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association and also represent the Minnesota State Fire Departments Association. We're here today to discuss the safe haven provision for newborns. And thank Senator Benson. We have had some conversations about our concerns on this provision, and it's all relative to protecting the life of the newborn. By including the fire departments in Minnesota, we have a little more of a unique situation than in other states because of the majority of firefighters are volunteers, and we have most of our fire departments that are not staffed on a regular basis. With that, I'll turn it over to my assistant fire chief for more information.
Mr. Chair and committee, my name is Steve Coring. I'm the assistant fire chief for the city of Eden Prairie, and I am here representing the state fire chiefs today and kind of being the voice of the fire service about the concerns that we have about this particular bill. We have a great deal of respect for the ideology around what we're trying to accomplish, protecting our most vulnerable human beings in our community. But some of the challenges of involving the fire departments in this very unique way of attacking a problem is going to be a little bit more problematic, we feel. As Ms. Munyon said, of the 791 fire departments, only 15 are staffed full-time in our state. The remainder are a variety of models, mostly paid on-call volunteer fire departments who respond unpredictably when duty calls. Some of those fire departments can respond as little as 15 to 20 times a year to their fire stations for a fire call. And the likelihood of a person being available at the point of contact when a person would drop something, a baby off at the fire station, would be highly unlikely and extremely unpredictable. Our concerns about the safety of that child and supporting the parent who's making that very difficult decision is a huge part of why we are in business. It's all about risk management, and we feel in our risk management model this would be an extremely problematic solution involving the fire service in this bill.
Thank you, Chief, and I just want to recognize and let members know that Chief Coring is the assistant chief in Eden Prairie, where I serve, and I'm surprised you didn't make George come down and testify, but he must be busy fighting fires this morning. Is that correct?
Other meetings.
Right. But we're glad you're here, and we appreciate what you do. And Eden Prairie is certainly one of those volunteer fire departments that you were talking about. And I have friends and neighbors who have been or are volunteers, and I know that they are not always there. Most of the time, they're at their normal job, and they get called as needed. And it's a valid concern. Ms. Munson?
Mr. Chair, if I could add the articles.
Can you please? The microphone needs to be right under your chin.
The articles that we distributed go to the point that Senator Hoffman made. We know that the language has been recrafted to encourage the mother to leave the baby with a person at the department. But I think when we have a mother in crisis who shows up and nobody's there, they don't always follow that. These are four instances in different communities where the mother left the baby without putting it in someone's arms.
And can I ask, and just out of curiosity, even though we do not have a provision in law that promotes leaving children at fire stations, has this happened in Minnesota? Have people dropped off infants at fire stations in Minnesota?
Chief, anecdotally, the information that, you know, just searching through the internet and looking for examples of that, the information that was distributed to the committee, I don't know if there's examples of a Minnesota fire department in that information, but I think, you know, our concern really is that you can say there are full-time 24/7 fire departments in the state that could potentially be available. The problem is that within our communities, those 791 communities that we talked about, most people within those communities, no matter how much public education you do, no matter how much time you spend working with them, most people really believe that there are some firefighters and a Dalmatian sitting around the table just waiting for the call. And the likelihood that a person in distress trying to make a very difficult decision would be able to locate the fire station that has a 24/7 response. And in today's models of economy, some of those 24/7 stations being staffed with fewer firefighters are now being less likely to be in stations because they'll be on runs and not staffing fire stations. So that, I think, is the risk. That putting that baby at risk of not being able to be found for a long extended period of time and not having a human being to actually do that pass off and protect the rights of that very vulnerable child.
Thank you. And I do want to, Senator Benson, ask Ms. Warsheim to this point, in crafting the bill and the language of the bill, in broadening the places where a person could leave an infant, was this decision made on the basis of experience in other states, or why was the fire station included as one of the places to do that. Do you have any history on that for us?
Mr. Chair, a couple of things. One was by reviewing, all 50 states have some version of safe haven laws. As we reviewed policies in other states when we were interested in expanding our locations, this, what we arrived at for this bill, probably fits somewhere, I would say, in the middle of what other states have provided. We also convened a large group of community members in southeast Minnesota last fall. I think probably covered about 8 to 10 counties. And that was following the discovery of an infant in the Mississippi River. And as those communities were coming together in terms of a response to that, what we heard from them was under our current provision, which only allowed for babies to be brought to a hospital, and so few communities have hospitals, that we needed to broaden the locations where an infant could be presented. That's why we included clinics, fire departments, law enforcement agencies, so that there would be at least one of those locations available in every small community.
Senator Hoffman.
Well, just a couple questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The town that I live in is 300 people, and it's an all-volunteer fire department, so they are never open for business. So I'm a little concerned about that, and I'm glad to see you're working on the language. And then another question I have is 7 days long enough of a period of time to be able to place a baby in somebody else's care? Just my experience with postpartum moms is sometimes it could take up to 30 days for the crisis mode to hit in, you know, the hormones and everything that happens. I'm not going to get into all the medical stuff that I've seen, but I'm wondering if 7 days is a long enough term. I'm kind of trying to figure out how we come up with an arbitrary date of 7 days.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Warshin.
Yes, Senator Hoffman. I appreciate your concerns. What the purpose of the safe haven law is really for those births which are typically happen in situations where a pregnancy has been concealed, a birth is often unattended, and the parent, rather than abandon the baby in an unsafe place or who otherwise might feel there's no choice but to harm the baby in some way, would exercise their right under safe haven to deliver the baby to a safe place without fear of prosecution for abandoning the baby. If the baby's older than 7 days old and mothers would get into the kind of situations you're talking about, there are other legal ways to relinquish custody of the baby by presenting to, perhaps a social service department or calling for help. So there's ways for that to happen. This is really for a very narrow kind of experience that we're trying to cover with Safe Haven.
Senator Newman, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For any of the testifiers, I'm looking at page 6, line subdivision 1, where we've got a safe place is a hospital licensed, and then goes on to say that the newborn must be, this is at line 6.18, must be left with a hospital employee. Is there similar language that indicates the newborn must be left with, for instance, a clinic employee or a policeman or a fireman or a paramedic or something like that?
Senator Benson or Ms. Warshine?
Look at the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I think the amendment that Senator Benson just added to the bill strikes a hospital, so the newborn needs to be left with an employee on the premises.
My mistake. I appreciate it.
And Ms. White, just to I see the first part of the A2 amendment, page 6, line 15. Is that what you're talking about or some other part of the bill? Page 5?
Talking about the next one.
It's line 1.6 on 1.4 through 1.6 that amends that.
Okay, line 24.
We've been collaborating.
So, okay.
Mr. Chair?
1.5.
Well, Mr. Chair, there is
Ms.
other...
Borshek.
Senator Newman, there is other language on pages 24 and 25 of the bill that covers the fact that the baby would be left with a person in those other locations.
So, Senator Newman, do you have your question answered? Are you,
Mr. Chairman, my question has been answered. I missed the language on the A2 amendment.
Okay. All right. Are there other questions from committee members on the safe place provisions in the law, in the bill? I guess one question I have, Senator Benson, and there have been some concerns raised by the chiefs and Senator Hoffman. Is there a plan, or what are we thinking about with respect to changing the provisions to satisfy the concerns, legitimate concerns being raised? Is there some thought yet of how we want to proceed? We may not want to do it today, I understand that, but just any thoughts on what direction we're going to take?
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have to echo Senator Hoffman. I grew up in a town of 300 people, and both of my brothers and my father was a volunteer firefighter, and so I'm well aware that stations are only manned on drill night and when there's a grass fire or a barn burning down. So I, with that in mind and the understanding that there are 15 full-time firehouses that only cover a limited geographic area, we're going to be making some changes. We'll be working with the department. The overall objective here is for a mother in crisis to do the right thing, turn her child over to somebody with responsibility who can take responsibility for that child and for that mother to not be prosecuted. That's the big goal. And so to the extent we can accomplish that without encumbering our chief of police and the police and the policemen at their departments, encumbering the fire departments, and we don't want to send a signal that babies should be left outside a fire department. That is just as dangerous as being left in a grocery store, perhaps more so, because nobody is in the fire department. And so we will work, and I will be happy to work with all the stakeholders and the department to ensure that we're comfortable when we get to judiciary. We don't want to increase the risk of losing an infant by advertising that babies can be left at a fire department and then on a 20 below night, babies wrapped up and left at the door of, you know, the small town fire department. That would be a horrible outcome of this legislation. So we'll take all those things into consideration, conference, and amend in judiciary.
All right. Thank you, Senator Benson. And Ms. Bunyan or Chief Coring, any thoughts from your side of what kind of solution we ought to be looking for? Have you thought about this or suggested any language that you're willing to share with us right now?
On behalf of the fire departments, we think that the best solution is to ultimately exempt fire departments so that we don't create confusion in the minds of a distressed mother, and we'll continue to work with Senator Benson and law enforcement on an amendment.
So you're saying exempt fire departments and maybe designate fire chiefs to be the persons that would receive the... No, I'm just kidding. All right. Well, I appreciate your willingness to testify and raise the concern. Legitimate, and we have a commitment that we will find ways to address that. And I think it's no one's intent to try to pass a law that is opposed by the people who are going to be affected by it. But we all recognize the need to find some way to... make sure that if there's a safety issue with a newborn child, that we're doing the best we can. And we do have a question from Senator Rosen. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand, Senator Bench, you're really in a pickle on this bill, because even if you exempt the fire departments, there's still going to be that obvious move towards a fire department if you're in a crisis situation. You just had a baby. You're going to want to think about it. So I guess my question is, is there some, and perhaps the department can answer this, some kind of training program, or is there a campaign out there? How do you know where to put this baby if you, and it's a secret pregnancy, nobody knows about it? What are the options out there for if they need some information on what to do with this newborn?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Warsha.
Senator Rosen, along with the bill, the department plans to develop educational materials, promotional materials that likely we would provide to local child support or child-serving agencies that would come in contact with these moms most often. So it might be a public health department, a social service department, institutions of education. Getting information out about what this safe haven and safe place law is all about. There has been very little public awareness around it. At one time there was a part-time nonprofit organization that did that work, but they have not been in business now for a few years. So we'll have to figure out a way to kind of fill that gap with public awareness and education. Materials.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Ultimately, the goal is what's best for the newborn, what's best for this child. And it may not be to put it back with the mother or the family. It may be to just go ahead and put it into adoption. But I think a public awareness program is essential to a bill like this, because you are obviously just going to have a panic, knee-jerk reaction of just putting it at a fire department or the door of any public building. And you can pass as many laws as you want, but if you don't have some kind of public awareness out there and information,
right?
It's a moot point.
Mm-hmm. Senator Benson, did you want to respond?
Mr. Chair, and I want to thank the fire department and our deputy chief. If I could call forward Jim Franken, the executive director of the sheriff's department.
Before we do that, Senator Benson, Senator Higgins had a question. I don't know if it's for the fire folks or not, but
no, it was just a comment that perhaps you could find an agency or an organization who could do a public service announcement that would go out on the radios, radio stations that young people listen to. I don't think there's much sense in putting it on some of the moldy oldie stations, but like I listen to. But you know, there are radio stations where young people do listen, and it would be an obvious place to put some information out for it.
It's a good idea. All right, thank you, Chief Coring and Ms. Munyon. And Senator Benson, you were going to invite some testimony from
The executive director of the. I believe it's Minnesota Association of Sheriffs. I'll let him introduce himself. And just have him briefly go over something that we're considering so it can be vetted before this group, and then we'll discuss this with the department and see where it goes.
And just before we get to that, Ms. Warsham, I wanted to ask you one question relating to this topic generally. If a mother of a newborn today were to leave their child on a neighbor's doorstep or some private citizen's doorstep, what is the status of that? Is that considered a safe place under the law, or is the person, unlike if they went to a hospital, subject to some kind of penalties, or what happens in that case?
Yes, Mr. Chair. In that kind of situation, it would be considered a child having been abandoned by the parent. The child would still probably go into the custody of a county agency. If that was indeed the mother's intent, it would go into a court process. Similar to what we're talking about today, that child would be in foster care, and there'd be an assessment made to see if that parent needed services or other interventions, or if there was other permanency that needed to occur for that child.
Is that different than what would happen if they bring the child to a hospital? I mean, isn't it the same?
Yes. Under the Safe Place for Haven, the parent would not be involved in any ongoing court proceedings. Okay. They've relinquished custody of the child. The child does go into the custody of the local agency. Most of the time, that child moves straight forward to an adoptive placement and adoption.
So the difference is if a mother brings a newborn to a hospital or a place under the safe place law, that child becomes immediately in the custody of the state agency and then placed for adoption, whereas if a parent brings a newborn to the neighbor and leaves the child, then there's a court proceeding involving the mother and foster. It's a different process entirely. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, there would be a different process. In fact, in the latter, leaving the child on the neighbor's doorstep, like I said, if the mother's intent was to abandon the child there, The first order of business would be to do what you could to reunify that child and parent. That would always be your first course, depending on what the circumstances are, assessing the mom, seeing if there's some kind of treatment or other intervention that might go to the situation that Senator Hoffman was raising earlier, a situation of postpartum depression, those kinds of things.
So why are those two circumstances treated differently in law? I guess I'm just curious what is the reason why we would treat them differently instead of treat them the same?
Not necessarily. Mr. Chair, I think that, and Aaron Sullivan Sutton just had briefed me on this, that really the safe haven laws came about in response to situations where babies were being, like I said, either abandoned somewhere where they were in life-threatening situations, or the first reaction was that the parent was harming the child, and oftentimes fatally harming the child. So safe haven is really for, like I said, for a very narrow population, narrow circumstances. Like I said, there's a number of other ways that children are abandoned, a number of other ways that children come to the attention of the Child Protection Agency. This is just about those cases where, without safe haven, the child might be harmed.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And I think, Senator Benson, you have another test for it. We'll invite you to identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jim Franklin. I'm the executive director for the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. We first learned about this particular piece of legislation, and as you know, sheriffs have a wide range of duties that interact with social services and the courts on a number of issues. Secondly, you've already heard Chief Corning talk about the difficulties both police and fire departments in the state have with regards to this particular law, and I won't go into or enumerate those. We as sheriffs are stepping forward thinking and proposing that we have a perhaps solution to this that we think is cost-effective, efficient, and can be done relatively quickly. Number one, the sheriffs of the state provide 911 communication and support for the entire state, with primarily the exception of the city of Minneapolis and Hennepin County that have municipal police-operated 911 centers. But for the vast majority of the state, the sheriff provides those services. Secondly, with inter-capabilities of transferring calls, a call from one office can be transferred to another office. As an example, if a call came into, say, the Golden Valley Police Department Dispatch Center or St. Louis Park, it could easily be transferred to the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office. Point three, we would dispatch a sheriff's unit to whatever the location is that the caller would identify or say they want to meet with the deputy to take custody of the child. We would take custody of the child. We would most likely order an ambulance to send that child to the closest hospital for medical care, treatment, evaluation, or any other things that would be needed. The sheriff's deputy would then take the reports, go directly to the social services, in which all of the social services aspects would then kick into play and the child would be cared for. So we thought that by simply stepping forward, trying to shortcut the process, the paperwork, and it's all within the county governmental structure, so we don't have issues about who's responsible for which. We don't have issues of liability. It all just basically falls to the county. We thought it would streamline the process, make it efficient and quick, and give the best care to the child that might be needing it at that time. That is sort of the big picture that we need to sort of craft some new words here in legislation to kind of put that into place, and hopefully that would be a good model that we could use in this state.
So, Mr. Franklin, just so I understand, you're proposing that instead of having the safe place be a actual place, that instead we would encourage mothers of newborns that are having these extraordinary circumstances to call 911. And then from that point, there'd be some action taken and directed primarily by sheriffs, particularly, in the counties outside of Hennepin County. But is that the idea?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it is. We do not object to, if you wish to name safe places. Number one, we do not think hospitals should be taken out. We think that's a very appropriate level of care. Number two, if you wanted to leave another medical clinic in, but again, the same problem, they're not necessarily 24-hour-a-day solution. We are trying to offer up a 911 24-hour-a-day solution to this particular thing so that if the mother or their designee could not get to a hospital, could not get to a safe place, they simply dial 911 and we would be there or meet them in order to take custody and move the process on.
Senator Hayden, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to our testifier. First of all, let me just ask a clarifying question. Would this be kind of in addition to having the mother or whoever dropping the baby off in a safe place? So would this be kind of an enhanced version of the safe haven? And I guess where I'm going with this is that often, and I think those that are social workers and people that work with folks that are in this crisis may want to weigh in, because I think that when I think about a young woman who is in this situation and is making this extraordinary choice to drop off their baby, I don't know if they would be in the position to, A, pick up the phone and call 911, wait for a law enforcement personnel to come and pick up their baby, if that's their mindset, and B, they often are in they're in situations in which maybe they don't want you to be there. So what if they are under the influence? What if they're in a situation that's dangerous for the child because of their living situation? People are doing things that you guys wouldn't like for them to be doing. So they're at a drug house or a place in which crime is happening. So I guess you kind of see where I'm going with this. I really appreciate the idea, and if it is an enhancement of something, an option that somebody could do, but I really would worry that we would get back to a situation where they would just dump their babies off in places that we don't want to if the law enforcement is really their only option in which to drop their child off at.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Franklin.
Mr. Chairman, Senator. It's not our intent to take away any of those other options that you enumerated. If this body wishes to have those incorporated in, that's fine with us. It's not our intent to become social services or provide those services. We are just simply trying to provide an efficient way that, when necessary, we would step in and do this. I would also hasten to say that, unfortunately, we as law enforcement officers sometimes find ourselves in those situations that you've enumerated rather articulately, and we oftentimes have to take the children away from them because of that environment, with or without this law. That's a whole other segment of the law, but we are sensitive to the issue that you raised, and it's not our intent to eliminate that or take on that function or responsibility.
All right. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bouncing off of Senator Hayden's comments, and I tend to agree, and I guess my question would be for you, Mr. Franklin, if there was a 911 call from a mother who wants to drop off her baby, would she be asked, who is this, give me your name, give me your information, or could she just say, the baby, I left the baby at the fire department, or the baby's this place? I mean, how much security is she is not going to call 911 if she has to give her name? Obviously, with some of the information that was passed out, they just leave little notes on there, and that's the whole problem, is that nobody knows about this pregnancy and they want it to stay that way. So there's got to be some kind of safety net for them to be able to call law enforcement without.
Mr. Franklin.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen. As you probably know, law enforcement takes dozens of phone calls every day that are anonymous without a reporting party's name, etc. So that is nothing new. Secondly, this legislation specifically calls for the fact that we are not authorized or allowed to ask for the identity of the person. So under that, we would not, if the person identified that we are wanting to drop a baby off, we would be training our dispatch staff to just simply then geographically find out where they can meet or where to go and not be asking those other routine type questions that we normally would ask if a common 911 call comes in for most people who do identify themselves. This is a unique portion of the law that we would train to address that issue.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin. That's exactly what I hear. What I hear, because this is child neglect, child amendment. This is, and no matter if you're in a crisis or not, this is a crime. It could be a crime, and so part of the campaign would have to include this ability to make sure that they know they are safe by calling 911. Because this is problematic to just drop them off at a fire hall. I see where that's a real problem. I serve a large greater Minnesota area, and you certainly don't want that, because that's not the best for the baby to be left out there and nobody drives by. They see a box or whatever. So 911, I could see where that would work, but that would absolutely have to have some comfort there that they are not going to have to give personal information, and that the best interest, again, is for that newborn.
Thank you. Other questions on the for the witness or on the whole safe place issue? I suspect that Senator Benson and Ms. Horsheim, you're getting a sense that there may be some concerns with the bill as it is written, but we do have the assurance that this will be addressed in some language that can address the concerns raised would be crafted by the time it gets to judiciary. Is that the hope?
That is, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. That is the reason I called Mr. Franklin up, to assure or reassure the committee that there is work to be done, it can be accomplished, and that this could still be sent forth to judiciary, and we'll do the work between here and there. If there's nothing else on this matter, I'm prepared to move the A3 amendment with your permission.
All right. Any other questions from members? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Franklin. Senator Benson moves the A3 amendment. Senator Benson, do you want to describe it briefly? Is this addition to or just deletion and replacing of language that's already in the bill?
Mr. Chair, there is a technical change to this amendment, and I would like to move it as an author's amendment.
Okay. Ms. White?
Mr. Chair and members, on page 11 of the A3 amendment, line 29, the effective date needs to be corrected. Delete 2011 and insert 2012. And on page 13, line 21, you'll notice this subdivision only goes up to clause 8. So 13.21, delete comma 9, comma or 10. And in between 7 and 8, delete the comma and insert or.
Okay, so members, a couple of technical amendments to the A3, and I guess I would suggest we incorporate those technical changes into the motion to adopt A3 as an author's amendment. Is that, Senator Benson, your?
Yes, thank you,
okay.
Mr. Chair. I move the A3 amendment.
Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, technically you get one author's amendment. You,
so
don't
you only get
oh,
one. All right, Senator Benson, it can't be an author's amendment.
I apologize. Mr. Chair, I asked counsel to break this into two pieces because these are fairly complicated issues.
All right.
And
so why don't we have a little description of the amendment then, and before we adopt it.
Good morning. I'm Dawn Van Ryan, and I work for the Child Care Assistance Program at the Department of Human Services.
Could you bring the microphone very close so that thank you.
I'm going to be speaking to Article 2, Child Care, and these are policy and technical changes. The first one in Section 1, and actually it is also a rule change in Section 10, but it's an administrative simplification change to change the date of eligibility for basic sliding fee child care assistance from the date to the date that the application is received. And currently, it's a little bit more confusing, and it's not in alignment with how other programs set dates of eligibility. Our policy also currently requires 15 days, that the application be received within 15 days of the parent's signature, which is a burden sometimes for families and for the county. And we also would like to make this change because it supports the development of an online application that is under pilot right now for health care, MFIT, food support, and child care assistance. Section 2 and 3 are a technical change, and it's a change to fix inconsistent language that's in the statute. In one place, we refer to equal to or greater than, and in the other place, it refers to less than. So it's just to clarify that that the eligibility requirement is equal to or greater than 67%, and that is our current practice. And it also changes monthly to biweekly in some areas of the statute, which was a change made when our online system went into place. Sections 4 and 5 are an administrative simplification change to align the background study requirements for non-licensed providers with the background study requirements for licensed providers. The non-licensed provider background study requirements have been in place for about 10 years, and initially they were aligned with licensing. We basically had they're almost exactly the same as the background study requirements for licensed family providers. But because they've been in two different places over the years, licensing has made updates to their background study requirements, and they do a lot more background study requirements, so they are on top of changes that occur in other statutes, and they've been able to reflect that. Ours are now out of alignment, and we would like to simplify the administration of the policies by putting them back into alignment with licensing by tying directly to the background study requirements for licensing. This is also a way to simplify processes for county workers because in a lot of counties, the same person does the background study requirements for licensed family and the non-licensed.
Can I ask, who pays the cost of the background check? And my understanding is that in a licensed situation, the licensee pays the cost. In a non-licensed situation, who pays the cost?
It is also the person who is applying to become registered as a provider.
So if I'm a non-licensed provider?
Yes. And you want to receive child care assistance program subsidies. Okay. Then you need to complete the background study. And as I said, that's actually been in place since about 2003. The background study requirements have been in place. We just want to align it. But, yes, it is the now, person.
I think it was yesterday we had, or may have been Monday, we had a presentation on some federal grant dollars that were going to be provided for the state to expand the scope of background checks to include fingerprinting, which would change the fee structure from, they described, roughly $20 to something over 75, or I'm not sure if there was a precise dollar amount, but significantly increasing the cost. Is that also going to apply to this particular provision?
No, we have separate language related to fees and background studies, and currently it's up to $100, but no more than the actual cost to the county, and that is not proposed to change.
So the federal grant that was being discussed the other day would not apply to the background study that you're doing?
I'm not familiar with the grant, so I don't know for sure, but I can
certainly I'd appreciate if you could try to take a look at that and just maybe let us know. Because my understanding was that this was a grant that was going to expand the scope and the cost and, in effect, require fingerprinting of everyone who's providing services and various, and I thought child care was one of them, but I'm not sure.
Child care licensing, yes. At this point, if the fingerprinting was required, our fee is not set to change. It would still remain the same.
Okay. Right. And please continue.
Okay. All right. Section 6 is it's a change to clarify what information needs to be part of the attendance records that child care providers who are receiving child care assistance subsidies currently must maintain. That's another policy that's been in place for some time, but the language didn't really specify what needed to be part of those attendance records. In some counties, they have requirements in place that are more specific. In some counties, they're less. So we want to kind of align that so they're similar across the state, and we want to clarify what things need to be part of that attendance record.
Excuse me. Senator Newman, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 3 of the A3 amendment, go to line 3.15 through 3.18. It talks about a background study on children between the ages of 10 and 13. Can you explain to me, you know, what kind of information would be disclosed on a 10-year-old child that would be, you know, of help in to you in this area? It really sounds young to me. But
yes, Mr. Chair, Senator, that's actually current policy, and that's also in licensing. But basically, we require it on all members of the provider's household who are 13 and older. We would only request a background study on an individual between 10 and 13 if they have a reasonable cause that there was some kind of concern related to the child that would be part of a public record, like juvenile records. We do not typically request them on children in that age range.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the reasonable cause defined by 245C.02 is what is that specifically? Is that juvenile records, or what are we talking about?
I don't think I have that reference right in front of me, but I can certainly get that to you. That's actually in the licensing statute.
But, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
What you're driving at here is if you believe there is a juvenile record, then you would have access to that. Is there any other information that you're looking for? I'm just trying to get a feel for what kind of information is the department going to wind up receiving on a 10-year-old child.
Senator Newman, maybe we could turn to Ms. White. She may be able to answer that question for you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the reasonable cause definition under this subdivision 15 is not specific to minors. I'll read it. Reasonable cause means information or circumstances exist which provide the commissioner with articulable suspicion that further pertinent information may exist concerning a subject. The commissioner has reasonable cause when, but not limited to, the commissioner has received a report from the subject, the license holder, or a third party indicating that the subject has a history that would disqualify the individual or that may pose a risk to the health or safety of persons receiving services.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Newman,
the information that you would be basing a requested background check on could be simply a letter or a report or someone that has been disgruntled with a neighbor with respect to this 10-year-old child.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it would most likely be information that the county has on the child that would have raised a concern that that child may put other children in care at risk. That would be the type of situation typically where they would request the background study, because they would be looking for specific elements that would be of concern that that person may not pass the background study, which are things related to assault, arson, those types of behaviors.
But, Mr. Chairman, I'll let it go. Just a comment that what is typically done, I can appreciate, but that's not what the reference statute said. The way when I listened to Senate counsel read that statute, Subdivision 15, it seemed to indicate that the source of information could literally come from just about any place, unless I misunderstood the statute. But that's how I read it. So I'm just raising a mm-hmm. question of concern as to what is it you're looking for and where is the source of the information coming from. What I, at least in my world, is really a pretty young child.
And just maybe along that same line, we kind of skipped over Section 5 of the bill that seems to address the persons who cannot be authorized, and there's a lot of language that is stricken that seems to define with some specificity who cannot be authorized, and it replaces it with the language on the bottom of page 3 and top of page 4, which also refers to background studies in Section 245C. Can you just give us a explanation of what's going on with the change in Section 5?
Mr. Chair, Section 4 and 5 are basically changing because there is very, very similar language in the licensing statute. And so what we want to do is, instead of continually trying to change our statute to make it the same as what is in licensing statute, we just want to tie directly back to the licensing background study statute. So everything that's being stricken is similar language to what's in licensing. So instead of every time licensing, which has not happened now. Right now, we initially started out, like I said, about 10 years ago, we started out and they were the same. Over time, theirs changed because they are in a better position because they do so many more background studies to keep it up to date. Ours has kind of lagged behind. By tying directly to what they have in statute, we don't need to necessarily keep looking at theirs to make sure that we're still in alignment.
So the intent is to try to align the licensed providers and the non-licensed providers to the same requirements for background studies.
Correct. And they are very similar currently, but have changed over time. We currently do the background studies on the children under 13 if there is that cause.
I guess I'm just kind of getting to the question of is there a difference between licensed and non-licensed providers or not? And I'm a little concerned about if the other provision we talked about earlier with respect to the fingerprinting and the more rigorous background check that the non-licensed provider is going to have to submit to as well, is there really a difference between licensed and non-licensed providers?
Mr. Chair, there's a difference between the provider types in that the licensed providers have the capacity to care for more children. I think that in either case, we typically would want to have the same standards for not making payments to providers who don't meet certain requirements. And the requirements that are in the background study language are typically fairly serious.
Well, and that's my question. Is the department moving in the direction of saying we really shouldn't have non-licensed providers?
Oh, Mr. Chair, no. No, we just want they still are completely separate. It's, as I said, I mean, initially the language was the same. We basically piggybacked on licensing language when this was put into place, I believe, in 2003. It's just that over the years they've become less in alignment. It causes workload issues for county workers who have to, when they do a background study on a licensed provider, they need to, look at this list of disqualifications, and then when they turn around and do a background study on a non-licensed provider, it's basically the same, but they have to make sure that this In this case, it's different. In this case, it's, you know, one thing. So it's the change is not significant in what the disqualifying factors are. It's just to make it more consistent.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, if at some point the state decides not to have non-licensed providers, that's a decision that the legislature makes. And, you know, the department will have a lot of input in that decision. But my first term here, we had an early childhood education division, and we spent a lot of time talking about whether we should go in that, you know, to not have non-licensed. And we ended up with this kind of the system that we have, and then it's been tuned over the years. But that is a policy decision of...
And Senator Higgins, I agree with you completely, and I was just trying to clarify if sometimes things can happen in rules or that makes the distinction no longer a clear distinction, and that's all I was trying to understand. It seems like that at least with respect to the background check portion of license versus non-license, the desire is to make them the same. And so that distinction would no longer, to the extent it did exist before, be in place anymore, that is not something that would distinguish license from non-license. And I appreciate that. I just wanted to clarify that.
And, Mr. Chair, I think it makes sense to just reference the other rather than having all of this in statute, because if it gets changed someplace, somebody has to remember to change it elsewhere. This way, if we reference it, it just automatically gets changed in both places.
I don't disagree, but thank you. Other questions? Senator Newman, are you satisfied to move on here? Okay.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Please continue.
Let's see. And I think I covered Section 6, which was the change to the record-keeping requirements, just that they specify which records must be kept. Section 7 is an administrative change. Currently, we do an annual market rate survey to look at what rates child care providers charge. We, at one point in time, that data was used on a regular basis to actually make changes to rates. That's no longer the case. And the federal requirement is that the survey be done biannually. So we would like to move in statute just to make that a biannual survey. And that also frees up administrative time to do additional research with the data that we do have and get more information out of that data. Section 8 is an administrative change to update the provider differentials for accreditation. Currently, we make a slightly higher payment to providers who have either certain credentials or accreditations showing that they've met higher standards than the basic licensing standards. Over time, some of those accreditations have changed. Sometimes the name of the agency no longer is the same. Some of them go out of business and a new one comes into place. So part of this change is to make changes to programs that are either no longer in existence or have had name changes. And part of it is to make a change to tie to the Minnesota Center for Professional Development Career Lattice, which is a place that providers can store their information about their credentials, about the education and training that they've had. And then we can look directly at that rather than, at this point, the provider is required to submit all the paperwork to prove that they've met some kind of requirement to get this additional payment.
Change that we need to make. I'm going to ask Ms. White to describe that for us. We can incorporate this into the amendment when we adopt it. But Ms. White.
Mr. Chair and members, it's another technical amendment for a date change. On page 9, line 4, delete 2012 and insert 2013. So beginning January 1st of 2013, the request would...
And members, we'll incorporate that along with the other date changes when we adopt the amendment. And Senator Higgins, let me just ask one question before we turn to you. I just want to get clarification. The Minnesota Center for Professional Development Career Lattice, is this a private organization?
It is sponsored by DHS, but it is, I believe it is operated by Metro State University, but I guess I'm not 100% sure of that. I could check that. But it's a place where providers actually can go in and store their own information and update their own records. And then if they do take training, that training will automatically link to that. So the provider would be less likely to have to send in paperwork okay. to the department.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I'm curious about on line 9.4 and 5. It looks like the requirement is just for family providers, and I'm wondering if that's correct and why it would only just be the family providers that is referenced here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, at this point, that is who is part of the career lattice. Centers are the accreditations are more based on the full center, whereas the career lattice is more based on individuals. So, in a center situation, you're more looking at a full center rather than each individual involved, and that's how our accreditations for centers are currently structured.
Thank you for the clarification. Mm-hmm.
All right. And before you continue, and Senator Benson, I do have a request from representative of the Minnesota Child Care Association, and I am familiar with, and I think we did have last year some discussion about this differential rate process, and there was concern raised, I remember last year, about which accrediting organizations were going to be allowed to participate in this, and I don't know if that's what Ms. Doslin, or did you want to come forward and bring some testimony?
Thank
and please
you,
identify
Chair.
Yourself.
And I wanted to clarify, we didn't have questions about that section. It's the next section on Section 6 regarding record keeping.
Okay. I apologize. I thought
That's
it was
right.
with this section. But let me go back then to just in Section 8 that we were just discussing. These associations that do the accreditation, have you been familiar with the challenges brought to there are some providers that think there should be other accreditation recognized, and what's your response to those concerns?
Mr. Chair, there are other actually bills being proposed that do look at including other accreditations. What the department would like to do is the current accreditations that are identified were not reviewed by the department in any way. It was a statutory change that was made that was not from the department. And we would like to have a more rigorous process of looking at the accreditations and making sure, because in some cases one accreditation is not equal to another accreditation. So we're looking at moving in the direction of having more of a process of doing that. Unfortunately, that would have a cost associated with that, so that is not part of this current proposal.
Okay. I guess, do you want to continue and talk about Subdivision 6, and then we'll ask Ms. Doslin if she has some testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Doslin, and I represent the Minnesota Child Care Association. We represent about 230 licensed child care centers around the state. Some you may be familiar with are New Horizons in Kinder Care and Tutor Time. We have seen this record-keeping language before. It was it's in the licensing bill that so far has been introduced in the House. MCCA has contacted the folks in the licensing department who brought this language forward to us. We've contacted them with some questions, and we haven't heard back from them. One of our questions is, why is it relate or apply to all children in a child care center and not just children who receive CCAP? So we're wondering what the implications are regarding private pay families. Does this mean that the department has jurisdiction over private pay families? And then we just have some logistical questions, which we certainly would like to work out with the department and have been, again, waiting back to hear from them regarding an email with some questions we sent them. Just some logistics about how do we keep track of that information. Many centers have They have check-ins that parents are responsible for checking in the child and checking the child out. What happens if a parent forgets to do that? So just some logistical questions that I think need to be worked out and resolved. And then we also have a question on kind of the future of that policy. Does that mean that families on CCAP will be their authorization would be based on an hourly rate versus, like I believe now it's a half day or a full day rate? So we are just concerned about some long-term implications on CCAP regarding that proposal. And as I said, we're happy to talk to the department. We are waiting to hear back from the licensing division regarding our questions on the section, which is also in the licensing bill. Great. And thank you for your time.
Okay. And I guess any response to those concerns? I think that is a legitimate question. This member's going back to page 7, line 19, for instance, requiring the attendance be kept for all children, not just for those who are receiving assistance. And then the other issues raised, what's the department's take on that?
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, there is language in the licensing statute related to license providers, and then there's also the language in this statute, which is related to providers who are caring for children receiving child care assistance subsidies. I believe the licensing is specific to centers. I'm not 100% certain of that. They did arise independently. They're similar, but we didn't actually work together on those. We already do require attendance records for the CCAP children. They haven't been specific as far as like time, sign in, sign out time, or who has been filling out the time that the child that the child was there. There are some counties who have already implemented this. Counties have a process where they submit a plan to us and they can include additional county optional policies. There are some counties that already do these additional elements in their attendance records. There's really two reasons that we're looking to make this change and to include all children. One is related to safety. In some cases, if we only know the kids who are there that are child care assistance program kids, we aren't able to tell from that if that provider is operating over capacity, how many children are there at a specific time, whether they have too many infants, whether, you know, they're meeting the requirements that are set forth. The second issue is that we have had instances related to program integrity where we have providers who bill for children who are not there or who are billing for children at times that that they aren't there. And we've had some requests from the Fraud Investigators Association to actually going back to the time when this language was initially passed to have more specific information and those in and out times so it's clear. We've also had concerns because there's some occasions where we have providers who are filling in that in and out time, and the family may or may not even be aware that the provider is doing that. So we want to have it be the parent or whoever is dropping that child off and picking them up be the one to fill out the form.
And I appreciate and understand the desire on the part of the state to know what's happening with respect to the monies that the state is providing.
Correct.
To assure that it's being well spent and there's not fraud or other misbehavior, let's say. But in the case of private pay families, why should they be required to submit all these data about their child and when he or she was there and when they left? Why would the state have that as their business to be collecting that information? Doesn't that raise some privacy issues and other concerns that are legitimate? I understand that you may want to make sure that there's not more than X number of children being cared for, but it seems to me that could be done without collecting detailed information from private pay families about their children and when they're there and when they're not there. I just am a little concerned that this is widening the scope to include people who are not part of the public assistance program, and I would believe that might raise some issues with folks. But
Mr. Chair, the attendance records are not... They're not something that the provider submits directly to the county or to the state. They're something that the county is required to hold on site, and they would only be accessed if the county had reason to believe that there were occasions where there were too many children there at a specific point in time, and there were issues related to that. It's also something that if a provider is participating in the child and adult food care program, that receiving funding for the food for the children, they need to keep attendance records for that too. In a lot of cases, they're already doing this, but I understand
Senator
your point.
Benson, were you going to make a comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was not aware of this issue, and in my reading of the amendment, I will be very honest, did not understand the gravity of concern for all children versus those children receiving child care assistance. And Mr. Chair, I will follow your discretion. Given the number of outstanding issues, some that I was aware of and am working on, and the hour at your discretion, I would be willing to lay this bill on the table, complete work, bring it back up according to your timetable.
Well, I maybe that would be appropriate, Senator Benson. I appreciate that. I think I know that there was concern about moving it to judiciary, and there are probably issues that could be dealt with there, but there may be some that this committee would like to have some opportunity to hear the resolution for. And if you're willing, then I would suggest we just lay this on the table for a time until you get some of these sorted out, and then we can bring it back. If you're willing to do that, that would probably be a good
yes,
way to
Mr.
go.
Yes, Mr. Chair, then I will move to lay this on the table. Okay. We'll resolve issues and not ask for a vote until we can be comfortable. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Senator Benson. Thank you for being here. And we are a little bit over time, not greatly, but I appreciate members' attention, and we are adjourned.